This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Paul McCartney. We're going to talk about his life and music through two new projects. He has a new two-volume set of books called The Lyrics, collecting his lyrics and the stories behind them, starting with songs he wrote before the Beatles and ending with songs from his latest album, McCartney 3, which was released late last year. There's also a new documentary, Get Back, which is about the 3 weeks the Beatles spent in 1969, writing, rehearsing, and recording the songs on their album Let It Be, and giving their final performance together on a rooftop in London's Savile Row. The band broke up before the album Let It Be was released in 1970. This documentary draws on footage that wasn't used in the 1970 film Let It Be that documented the same sessions. Get Back will premiere in 3 2-hour installments over Thanksgiving weekend on Disney Plus. Let's start with a song that kicked off the Beatles' first album.
1, 2, 3, 4!
Paul McCartney, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is such an honor to have you back on our show. So, did you know the count off would be left in that song when you recorded it? I love hearing the count off. It's kind of the equivalent of like an overture in a musical. It gets you like really excited for what you're going to hear.
Yeah. You know, that's one of the things about that song, really. And we use it just for practical purpose. Oh, by the way, hi, Terry, and
hi.
Listeners. Yeah. We use it for practical purposes, you know, just to count ourselves in. But I think that was a particularly exuberant one that our producer thought it'd be a good idea to leave in. So I listened to smart people.
So how did that become the B-side of I Want to Hold Your Hand? Like, why wasn't it the A-side?
I don't know. These are just decisions that are taken at the time. And I think I Want to Hold Your Hand was just stronger.
You're right. Eroticism was a driving force behind everything I did. That's what lay behind a lot of these love songs. Meanwhile, your fans were having a lot of erotic thoughts about you. Can you talk a little bit about what the experience was like of being like an object of desire at a time when, you know, when men are going through a time in your life that's typical of a highly sexualized period in a young man's life?
Yeah. The truth was, here's, you've got four young men in Liverpool, and pretty much you were looking for a girlfriend, and you were looking for sex. And the truth was, you weren't very successful. And you've got to remember also the period. This was sort of post-World War II in Liverpool. So it wasn't swinging London yet, you know. So we were just, yeah, you know, just like most young guys, you know, we just wanted to have a girlfriend and, you know, because as kids, we were apparently not very attractive. It was kind of the opposite for us, you know. So I suppose, you know, that kind of, as we got more and more popular and the girls started screaming and stuff, tell you the truth, we just enjoyed it. It was the fulfillment of all our dreams. And this idea that eroticism lay at the back of a lot that we would write, it sounds more important when you actually quote it. You know, it really was just young guys trying to get laid, as Americans would say.
So how did it change your life and your self-image when millions of teenage girls wanted you to make love to them?
It was very comforting, Terry. Extreme. It was very wonderful. And it was like, wow, look at this. Finally, we're attracting attention and all these girls seem to really like us. You know, we'd never experienced that If you're lucky, there'd be a girl down the street who might vaguely like you or something, you know. But suddenly it went wild, and I must say, we loved it.
You know something I kept thinking about reading some of your early lyrics and thinking about when I first heard the Beatles and when I first heard the songs and when I first saw A Hard Day's Night? I never had the chance to see the Beatles in concert, but I did see A Hard Day's Night when it opened. That was my first time outside of Ed Sullivan when I was sitting in the living room with my parents and I wasn't going to scream. But in the movie theater, everyone was screaming and I was screaming too. And I can't tell you how out of character that is for me. And so I've always wondered, like, why was I doing that?
I know. It was an excitement. And your question, you know, what did we feel? We loved it. We felt excited back.
Until you didn't, though, right? Until you didn't feel that way.
Well, no, later, then it got a bit wearing because now the first sort of flush of the excitement had been going for quite a few years and we were maturing. So we were kind of, you know, it was like, oh, okay, it'd be quite nice to be able to hear the song we're playing. And we couldn't because it was just, you know, a million seagulls screaming, you know.
So let's get to another song. And this is the song that you describe in your book by saying, if pushed, I would say it's my favorite of all my songs. And the song is Here, There, and Everywhere, which is on the Beatles' 1966 album, Revolver. What makes this your favorite song or one of them?
Yeah, I think the structure of it, I like it. It always reminds me in structure of a great Cole Porter song, Cheek to Cheek, which Fred Astaire sang. And it starts off heaven, I'm in heaven, it goes through it. And then in the middle, it goes a lot to God, dancing, but it takes me back to heaven. And it's so neat the way it just wraps itself up that I always thought, wow, that's a great trick, you know. So Here, There, and Everywhere does that. Here, first verse, second verse, there, third verse, everywhere, and leading me back to here. You know, that was what attracted me. And then I think that wouldn't have been enough to make it my favorite song, but I think it's got a nice melody. So the combination of those always made it one of my big favorites. And that's a question you get asked a lot, you know, what's your favorite song? So, but that one, when I'm pushed, I will pull that one out of the bag. And it is definitely amongst my favorites.
Okay, so here's Here, There, and Everywhere.
To lead a better life, I need my love to be here.
That's Paul McCartney's song, Here, There, and Everywhere, which was on the Beatles' 1966 album, Revolver. Did John have any input on that song? It's officially a Lennon-McCartney song, though it's really your song, and you now put your name first on the songs that you're primarily responsible for.
John had always a little bit of an influence. But often I might have written the whole thing myself. And then when we came to record it, you know, there would be some influence. I can't remember whether he wanted to change a word or something. But when the songs were songs that I mainly presented to him and the band as a finished piece, then that's what I've done in the book, is to put my name first.
What was the process of writing songs with John compared to writing them by yourself?
Writing with John was a lot easier because you've actually got a sounding board. You're sitting across from someone And we normally wrote on two acoustic guitars. So he'd be sitting there, I'd be sitting here, and one of us would suggest an opening line. And then the other one would go, okay, and would make a suggestion for the second line. So you would kind of ping-pong. And if a line was terrible, the other person would say, that's terrible, and we'd scratch it. So just with that process of the two of us making this piece, it was quite easy. Don't want to make it sound too easy, but, you know, it made the process very enjoyable and easier, because you didn't have to, if you had a line that you were questioning in your own mind, if you're writing on your own, you could spend a good half hour going, oh, what, this is terrible. What can I do? Think of something quick. Whereas with John, you just go, oh, this is terrible. You go, yeah, I know. And we'd fix it. Between the two of us, we would just improve it. So it was easier.
If it was so good writing songs together, why did you end up writing songs separately?
It was just a question of location, really. I mean, if I was on holiday and I wanted to write a song, John wouldn't be there. So I would just write the song, and I wouldn't think, oh, I've got to wait till I see him. And the same happened with him. You know, I would just be somewhere feeling the song, and it was often just that, proximity. You know, if we weren't able to just meet up that day, but you still had an idea for a song. So, for instance, the song yesterday, the melody came to me in a dream, and I played that intact to John, and he said, oh, I like that. You know, I was basically asking him if this was somebody else's melody. I couldn't believe it was mine, because it arrived in a dream. And then when I was on holiday in Portugal, there was a long drive from Lisbon down to the south coast, and I put the lyrics together there. So it was just a different process.
So let's hear another song that Paul McCartney writes about in his new book. This is Let It Be.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see. There will be an answer, let it be.
So the new documentary, which uses different footage from the film Let It Be, it kind of rewrites the narrative in ways that I haven't seen for myself, because I've only seen an excerpt of the film. The film hasn't been released yet. And I'm wondering if it rewrites, like, how you see it as rewriting the story of the end of the Beatles, of the final days of the Beatles.
Yeah, I think that was something that I said to Peter Jackson originally, the director.
He directed, yeah.
Yeah. When I knew Peter was going to look at all the footage, I said to him, I'm not sure I'm going to like this, Peter. I said, because it was from a very difficult period in my life, and it's always looked like I broke up the Beatles. And that isn't the case, you know, but it's the film came out and gave that impression in the associated, journalism around it. So I said, I'm not sure I'm going to like it. So he went off to New Zealand, where he works and lives. And a few weeks later, he sent me back a text saying, no, it's not like that at all. He said, this is just four guys working out songs, having a lot of fun. Said, you know, there's one or two little tense moments maybe, but we put that down to that's any family. You know, it's not all just roses. But generally speaking, this was a bit of a rose garden. You know, it was us enjoying being back together, showing each other our songs, learning them, and having fun with them. And so I think that's a great thing, you know, because as I say, at the time, I, for some crazy reason, I got blamed. I know why it was. It was because when I put my first album out after the Beatles, I was sent a questionnaire that said, ask various questions about the Beatles. And there was something like, will the Beatles get back together again or something? When are they getting back together again? And I said something, no, I don't think so, or something. I can't remember exact reaction, but it was something like that. And then that became blown up into the big headline. Paul says the Beatles are finished or whatever. And so that became Paul must have finished them. So I didn't really have a chance to say, no, wait a minute. There was a meeting and John walked into it and the other Beatles and me were in this room and John walked in and said, I'm leaving the Beatles, you know. That never came out.
What was your reaction when he said that? Were you prepared for that? And how did you feel about it?
No way. We were gobsmacked. You know, we were very shocked. And it was, I think, the first question, well, was in our minds, well, is this going to last? Or is this just something very John-ish where he would just say, hey, big dramatic statement. And then he'd go off. And then a couple of weeks later, he'd go, oh, you know, maybe we should get together again. So, yeah, it was quite shocking. You know, you can imagine someone just walks in and tells you the factory is closing, you know, shocking. And I think we wondered whether it would get together again. And when it didn't, it left us all, well, in one way, without a job. But, you know, later I realised that it was John had this new relationship with Yoko and he had to clear the decks in order to give her full-time attention.
And she's often accused, and maybe accused is too strong a word, but maybe it's not, but she's often accused of having broken up the band by distracting John away from the band and by totally changing his course of direction in a way that, you know, not everybody approved of, as if they had a vote. And then in the film, you see her sitting in on the session. How did you feel about her presence at the recording session and the rehearsals?
Yeah, at the time, it was very difficult because, you know, we knew John was infatuated with Yoko. And having known John so long personally, I knew that what he liked in a woman, you know, and he liked strong women. His aunt Mimi, who raised him mainly, was quite a strong woman. And I think he liked that. So when he met Yoko, he was very attracted to her. And I think it was a great thing for him. You know, I think he needed it. It was time for him to break loose and do some new things. And I knew it was exciting for him, you know. But at first, we were not too keen on it at all because it was like, who is this? And why is she sitting on my amp? Yeah, and for me, you know, this having been my employment and my artistic world for quite a number of years and having known John since we were teenagers together to this point, to it finally coming to an end was, very challenging, you know. It was, I mean, first question, well, okay, what do I do now?
You'll be 80 in June, and I'm wondering how that's changing what you want out of life, what gives your life pleasure and meaning?
Family. You know, I have 8 grandchildren. I have a fantastic wife. I have lovely kids. And I think, you know, that is definitely the focus. I'm very lucky to still enjoy creating music. So the focus there is pretty much the same, which is just to enjoy making music. But, you know, I think spending more time with my grandkids, I think it's what most grandparents would say. You know, hey, I can't believe I'm a grandparent. I mean, you know, I'm like these, I'm 25 years old, actually. You know, I just look older. And people, I think my birth certificate was falsified.
Are there like vulnerabilities, insecurities from your youth that in spite of everything you've achieved, in spite of all your success, in spite of all your talent, in spite of all the experience that comes with age, that stayed with you? Did any of those vulnerabilities and insecurities from way in the past stay with you?
I mean, I think there are two answers to that. It's like no or all of them.
Explain,
I'm not
please.
I'm quite sure which way to go.
go in both directions. Because life is full of contradictions.
Oh, yeah, baby. You better believe it. But, you know, it's great, though, because of that, all the paradoxes and everything. It is great. What did Shakespeare say? What was it like? There are more things in heaven than earth than are dreamed of in your philosophy. And that's true.
But tell me about both of those directions of like all of those insecurities staying with you and
well,
none
you know,
of them.
I don't know. Who knows? Terry, who knows? I mean, you know, I think the answer really is no. I think I've kind of worked most of them out and I don't think there are any. But you're just still this little person inside this body with all these thoughts, you know, that nobody else knows about.
I thank you so much for being on our show today. Just thank you immensely.
Well, listen, Terry, I mean, I listen to your show. I listen to NPR all the time. I'm not just blowing smoke here. So I do. So I want to thank actually everyone connected with all these public radio stations because they're great. They really, you know, and you particularly, thanks for doing this and sending my love.
Oh, right back at you. Thank you so much, and be well. Paul McCartney's new 2-volume collection of his lyrics is called The Lyrics. The new documentary about the making of the Beatles album Let It Be is called Get Back. It will premiere in 3 2-hour installments on Disney Plus Thanksgiving weekend. In 2006, the Showtime cable network introduced a new drama series and protagonist who upped the ante on the idea of central character as anti-hero. Michael C. Hall, who played David on HBO's 6 Feet Under, starred as Dexter Morgan, a serial killer who channeled his murderous impulses by preying exclusively on other serial killers. That series ended 8 years ago, but now a revival series called Dexter New Blood comes to Showtime this weekend with the actor and the character picking up the story a decade later. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
To me, and to many fans of the original Showtime series Dexter, that show had 2 endings. One brilliant, one terrible. The brilliant one was at the end of season 4, when Dexter, played by Michael C. Hall, squared off against another serial killer hiding in plain sight. The Trinity Killer, played by John Lithgow. Lithgow won an Emmy for that season-long guest role, and no wonder. His character, like Dexter's, was unusually, unpredictably complicated, and as compelling as he was creepy. And that 4th season finale, as bloody as it was haunting, would have been a perfect ending to the series, inflicting Dexter's childhood trauma on a new generation. Except Dexter, the series, didn't end there. Original showrunner Clyde Phillips, who had adapted the show from the novels by Jeff Lindsay, left. But the TV series continued for another 4 seasons. and when it ended, it was with a finale as unsatisfying as the one for Lost. Dexter, after the death of his beloved sister, was making plans to run off to Argentina with his girlfriend, another serial killer, who had already left the country with Dexter's young son, Harrison. Instead, Dexter faked his own death by steering his boat into the eye of a hurricane, and the series ended with a completely unsatisfying postscript, showing Dexter having adopted a new life and identity alone as a lumberjack in Oregon. I know, that's a lot of baggage and backstory to deal with, but that's the whole point. With this new continuation, called Dexter New Blood, Clyde Phillips returns and tries to set things right, and to sort of reset things. Based on the first four episodes, he's found a good way to move forward while building on Dexter's past. Parts of it, anyway. Dexter is back on the East Coast as this series begins, but not in Miami, where he used to work as a blood spatter analyst for the local police. He's now safely blended into a small community in upstate New York, where he calls himself Jim Lindsay, an obvious nod to Dexter novelist Jeff Lindsay. Jim works at a fish and game store in a place called Iron Lake, selling camping equipment and hunting gear to the locals, and to seasonal visitors like Matt, played by Steve M. Robertson, an obnoxious Wall Street trader to whom Dexter takes an instant an understandable dislike.
Anyway, how about that rifle?
The Remington 783 will do the job. It's got a good scope, solid construction. You drop it a dozen times, it'll still shoot straight.
Yeah, I hear you, man. Here's the thing. My friend Bill over there?
Yeah?
He's already got that one. And I want a gun that's gonna make his one look like a super soaker. So, that one. I want that one.
You sure? It's going to set you back $9,000.
I got a nice Christmas bonus at Morgan Stanley.
Oh, okay. You know, this is way more firepower than anything you need hunting around here.
Oh, yeah? What do you hunt?
Me, I don't anymore. I haven't killed any animals since I was a teenager.
I really like some of the plot developments established in this Dexter New Blood relaunch. But for every inspired choice made, there's another choice that's regrettable. Once again, Dexter has positioned himself in a way that puts him close to law enforcement, and that's cleverly done. But now, instead of being advised, if not haunted, by the spirit of his dead father, Dexter now deals with the spirit of his dead sister, played by Jennifer Carpenter. And that's no upgrade. Most effective is what happens when we learn about the fate of Dexter's now teenage son, Harrison, played by Jack Alcott. This new series might justifiably be called Dexter, The Next Generation. And since the original Dexter series built itself around the twisted, convoluted relationship between father and son, it's not only fitting but fascinating that Dexter New Blood explores a similar dynamic. Only this time, it's with Dexter as the not-so-dear old dad.
David Bianculli is a professor of television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey. Filmmaker Edgar Wright has two movies that came out this year. The first is a documentary called The Sparks Brothers about the rock band Sparks, led by brothers Ron and Russell Mayall. He directed and co-wrote the new movie Last Night in Soho, which was just released. It's a mix of thriller and ghost story. Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger spoke with Edgar Wright and can tell us more.
Last Night in Soho is about a present-day young woman named Eloise. She goes by Ellie, who grew up in small-town England, in love with the 60s scene of London. She gets accepted into the London College of Fashion and moves there, full of big city dreams. However, she doesn't get along with her roommate and is at odds with the dormitory's party scene. So she finds a room for rent in Soho, in a home owned by Miss Collins, played by Diana Rigg. It was Rigg's last role before she died. Ellie is played by Thomasin McKenzie.
Miss Collins?
Yes?
It's Ellie. We spoke on the phone.
Oh, yes. Room is on the top floor. Have a few rules. Don't take smokers.
I don't smoke.
No male visitors after 8 o'clock.
That's a problem.
And no using the laundry room at night. It rattles right through to mine.
I don't do laundry.
Aye?
I mean, I don't do nighttime laundry. I do laundry. I'm very clean.
Good. It's a bit old-fashioned for some, but I won't do nothing to it. If you don't like it, you can find somewhere else.
It's perfect. I love it.
Ellie has some sort of sixth sense and is sensitive to ghosts. As she falls asleep in her new bedroom, she dreams of a former occupant, a young woman named Sandy, living at the height of the swinging 60s and pursuing her dreams of becoming a singer. Sandy is played by Anya Taylor-Joy. Ellie's dreams outshine her waking hours, and she goes to bed every night excited to live out Sandy's life. However, the dreams turn to nightmares that begin to haunt Ellie even when she's awake. Edgar Wright co-wrote Last Night in Soho with Christy Wilson-Cairns. Along with his new documentary, The Sparks Brothers, Wright's other films include Baby Driver, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, The World's End, Hot Fuzz, and Shaun of the Dead. Edgar Wright, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me again.
I read that you wanted to make this movie for a long time. What was the original inspiration?
A lot of things have been percolating in my head with this one, and I guess the sort of the two things that kind of really inspired it. One was not dissimilar to Eloise in the movie. I had an obsession with the 60s that started with my parents' record collection. They didn't have a big record collection. They had one box of records that was just 60s albums. And I guess it kind of occurred to me later that they stopped buying albums when my older brother was born. So there were no 70s albums. And because I was spent a lot of time, my parents like worked two jobs a lot of the time. So I was frequently left alone with the, you know, in the days before the internet, and I would just listen to those records a lot and sort of almost like just disappear into that decade through the music. And I think in that strange way where you know, the film is sort of about having nostalgia for a decade that you never lived in. And I certainly had that because I was born in 1974, and I always found it strange, you know, that I was obsessed with the 60s and maybe with that nagging feeling that I just missed out. So that would be one inspiration. And then the other big part of it was London itself and moving to London when I was 20. And in the 27 years that I've lived in London, I've spent more time in Soho than any couch in any apartment I've ever lived in.
For people who live in the States and might not know Soho, what's that neighborhood like today and what was it like in the 60s?
So Soho is a square mile in the middle of central London. It's right in between like the West End, which is our theatre district, and on the other side is Oxford Street, which is the main shopping thoroughfare. And Soho is like sort of a bit of a law unto itself because for hundreds of years, it's been a place where, you know, like artists and I guess like the sort of the underworld kind of like mingle, in that it's been like the sort of the center of show business. And indeed it is the center of the film and TV industry. And it's like a major nightlife area and probably the only part of London that is genuinely 24/7. But there is a darker side to Soho. I mean, certainly, you know, like historically it's been kind of seen as a den of iniquity in terms of like the criminal underworld and the sex industry. And I guess in the time that I've been there, it's been all of that's sort of been gentrified out, but not quite. And more recently, in the last 5 years since I edited Baby Driver, I've started living very close, like literally, you know, 90 seconds walk away from Soho. But, you know, it was really important to me to shoot it in the area. And I think if at an early stage, producers or my location manager had said, Edgar, this is impossible, we can't shoot in the real Soho, we have to fake it somewhere else, I probably wouldn't have made the movie. I could get invested in a project if I can ground it in reality, especially in a movie like this that is very fantastical, you know, a supernatural tale that sort of turns into sort of full-on psychological horror. Having a grounding in the real location was so important to me.
So Last Night in Soho is about an innocent going to the big city to live her dreams and the trouble she gets into. That could have been a movie full of cliches. How did you try to avoid them?
Well, in a way, one of the inspirations for the movie was that genre of films from the 60s. Because I watched a lot of those films, and there are some very good ones, and there are a lot of other, like, more sort of B-movie ones that are very sort of sensationalistic and moralistic. That genre of, like, girl comes to London to be a star and has the audacity to want to make it big and will be roundly punished for her efforts. And at that point, it's almost like the city becomes the villain. It's like London is there to chew you up and spit you out. And I watched many of those films, and I thought it was interesting because the majority of them are written by men and directed by men, and you start to get this sense that those films were the old guard slapping the wrist of the younger generation. So it was like a rebuke to the progressive movement. And I thought that was really interesting. And so part of the conception of the movie was like how to subvert that by showing the story of a modern girl coming to London and having the experience of a 60s starlet coming to London.
So the 60s of your movie hasn't really been touched by the counterculture. It's very dominated by white men in flannel suits who are happy to prey on the ambitions of young women. We're far from the women's movement here. And I think people don't always remember that a lot of the 60s probably felt a lot like the 50s and the 40s.
Well, I think that's true. And I think even in terms of, I think, in reality, the swinging 60s didn't sort of permeate out through to the mainstream immediately, like, and not just the rest of the country, but even in suburban London. And I think that was something that I wanted to capture on screen, because a lot of films that maybe do period stuff will kind of be in this almost like Austin Powers version of London, where everything is kind of like sort of cool and groovy and everybody's hanging out on Carnaby Street in mini dresses. But there is the other side of it where, like, I mean, there's a scene in the movie that I find very, like, sort of one of my favorite images in the movie, even if it's a disturbing one, is Eloise at one point wakes up in a club and she's the only woman sitting in this kind of sea of gray middle-aged men. I was always taken with, when you look at archive from the time, that even men in their 20s look like they were in their 40s, because everybody's like chain smoking and everybody's wearing a suit, and it's very formal. And that is something that I think that the more sort of like outre fashions and stuff didn't start to permeate out until the late 60s or even the 70s, you know. So I thought that was something that I wanted to capture on screen. And that was, you know, when you actually look at movies from the time, that's something that's kind of was very sort of striking to me, that it was different when you look at the actual movies from the time than necessarily people recreating that period on screen sometimes.
You know, the movie I have been kind of describing as a ghost story. And I'm just wondering what your feelings are about ghosts.
I mean, I think that's very accurate, because it's not just ghosts in a supernatural sense. It's also like the ghosts of the past, even just in a cultural sense. You know, like the thing about Soho is that the kind of the shadow of the 60s looms very large over the whole area still to this day. I've never seen a ghost, but I do believe in them, or at least I believe in, if not in the kind of the traditional sense of ghosts being souls left on earth in torment, I do believe, as is put forward in the film as well, the idea of like some kind of psychic residue left behind by an event. And I think most people, if you found out that a murder had happened in a room, I think a lot of people would be very attuned to what that might mean. I think about that a lot, because in a way the whole movie is like inspired by the idea of what have these walls seen. But that, on top of that, my mother is, I would say, very supernaturally switched on, in terms of like my mum is the sort of person who feels presences in old buildings and has seen ghosts. And I, growing up, never kind of questioned that. But she had this, and one of her many stories, and in fact, since she's seen the movie, they've all kind of tumbling out again. I think my mum watched it and thought it was like a documentary, because I think she saw herself and Eloise in a big way. And even in my family house, where I lived from the ages of 7 to 20, my mum had seen or felt the presences of two separate ghosts of two previous inhabitants. A standard story from my mum would be maybe at the dinner table, my mum would say, oh, I saw the ghost of a hangman in the living room this morning and I told him to piss off and he disappeared. So that's good. And me and my brother would say, yes, okay, right, you know. But it's the thing is, I totally believe my mum, and I'm very, if I haven't seen a ghost myself, I'm very like ghost curious. But on the flip side, even as a sort of teenager, I would probably knew enough not to go and share that with my friends in the playground the next day.
Sure, sure.
Or you know, because I would know what they would think about that.
Reading about your life, I noticed there were some parallels between you and your main character, Eloise. You grew up in a small town. It's actually a town that you used in Hot Fuzz to depict the quaintest, sleepiest town in all of England. So,
but with dark secrets.
Yes, of course. But on the surface, really quaint and sleepy. So what was it like growing up there?
Well, I think it's that thing that when you're like growing up, especially as a teenager, you do not appreciate the place that you live in for what it is. Obviously now as an adult, I love the idea of it. And I think maybe, oh, wouldn't it be nice to move back there in a way? But at the time, you know, when you feel like you're away from like where it's happening, and not just London, even like the nearest big city to me was Bristol. And even Bristol, which was like maybe like 40 minutes drive away or 90 minutes on a bus, that felt like a big deal to go to Bristol and like go to a place that had like, you know, independent record shops or like a comic book store or like cinemas that were showing like independent movies. I remember as soon as I got a car when I was 17, I just sort of expanded my cinema watching. It was like the first thing I did was drive to Bristol to sort of go to the local art house and sort of pretend to be an adult and like pretend like I actually enjoyed black coffee and carrot cake. And
did you have a beret on? Or?
Not a beret, but I remember going to a screening of Barton Fink and thinking that everybody in the audience looked like Barton Fink. But it was that thing I was trying to fit in. I was thinking, trying to look like a cineast and thinking like, I mean, I've now grown a taste for black coffee, but at the time I think I was faking it.
Well, you grew up in the era of video rental stores. Were there movies that you would just rent over and over again?
Well, funnily enough, I did grow up in that era. However, my parents like did not have a VCR. And my mum and dad were like sort of kind of strapped for cash a lot of the time. They were sort of they were art teachers, and then they dropped out of teaching to be artists. And that was tough because I saw them kind of like struggle with their various small businesses and just as trying to make a living as artists. And so we never had a lot of cash growing up and stuff. And so one of the things is like, we can't afford a VCR. So all of the films that I wanted to see were higher ratings than I was allowed to, whether it was like American Werewolf in London or Carrie or even Alien or The Thing. So sometimes with those movies, there's two things I remember very vividly. One was that I would sometimes watch them round at my older brother's friends' houses who did have VCRs. And usually during the day when their parents were at work, sitting kind of in a living room in the middle of the day watching Nightmare on Elm Street or Carrie. The other thing I remember very vividly was going to video stores and just standing in the video stores reading the backs of the VHSs and the synopsis and trying to imagine what the film was like. And so I remember very vividly, maybe as a sort of 12-year-old, looking at, I don't know, the VHS cover for Brian De Palma's Body Double and trying to imagine what that film would actually be like.
I don't think you could do that with that movie.
No, I know, particularly with that one. The good thing about, with that one is that the content of the movie exceeds your wildest imagination.
Yes, it does, definitely. Was there a point when you were young where rather than just watching a movie for just the entertainment and the plot, like you thought to yourself, gee, I wonder how they did that shot?
Yeah, I would definitely, I think sort of early on, I when I started to realize that films were made by filmmakers, I think the first time I was aware of that, maybe even as a seven-year-old, was when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out. Because even in the promotion, it was like, from the producer of Star Wars and from the director of like Close Encounters. So it's like, oh, okay, I see. These are like sort of people that have made other things that I like are making a new film. And then from that point on, I was always very interested in film making, but I didn't necessarily think about directing. I maybe myself and my brother were sort of obsessed with, you know, creature makeup or like, you know, model making or some special effects element. But the kind of the light bulb moment was a documentary on British TV when I was at 14 years old. The chat show host, Jonathan Ross, had this show called The Incredibly Strange Film Show, which on network TV had hour-long shows on John Waters, another week Russ Meyer, another week Jackie Chan, another week George Romero. This is mind-expanding stuff as a 14-year-old. But the thing that kind of really was the light bulb moment was he did an hour on Sam Raimi. And specifically within the Sam Raimi story was the story that the director of Evil Dead had started making that film at the age of 18. And prior to that was making goofy shorts with his friends on Super 8 at school. And around that time, my parents had actually, knowing that me and my brother were interested in films and animation and effects, had bought us a secondhand Super 8 camera. One of those presents, by the way, that like spans, you know, the kind of like, this is your birthday present and your Christmas present, but it also went for me and my brother. So it was like one present between four events. So we had this Super 8 camera. I saw that documentary and then that was the light bulb moment. It was like, that's what I'm going to do. And it was like, from that moment on, it was like, I want to be a director, you know? And then that started almost immediately with like making goofy kind of like comedy shorts with my friends, like in breaks at school or after school or on like sort of during holidays.
Well, Edgar Wright, it's been a pleasure. Congratulations on both of your movies. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
Edgar Wright spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Wright directed and co-wrote the new film Last Night in Soho and directed the recent documentary The Sparks Brothers about the rock band Sparks. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.